Extraordinary careers, extraordinary stories, and for the first time, they're ready to tell them. These are the Narco Warriors. On the show this week, the depths drug smugglers will go to avoid detection.
We've been dealing with narco submarines for over 20 years.
Why the best intelligence is human intelligence, but only when you can trust what's being said.
The first thing you always do with an informant is test what they're telling you.
Handling grisly and unexpected surprises in the field.
And eventually they found a body in the water tank.
And why you can't always share secrets with your friends.
We're getting bollocked here by this guy because we wouldn't share with him the source of our intelligence.
This is Narco Warriors. Right, well, welcome to another episode of Narco Warriors. In our first episode, we looked at the origin story, the early careers of both Phil and Graham. And today, what we're going to be looking at is their life in customs in the 1980s, and also how they became drug liaison officers working in both America and Asia, and why we needed a drug liaison network at that time. So, Graham, first of all, starting with you, in the 1980s, what were you doing?
Yeah, I got promoted early in the 80s. Third year I was on drugs F&G, and I went out for 3 years to what was a local investigation unit. Then after I'd done my 3 years on the unit, I asked to transfer back to the investigation division, and I transferred back to the cocaine branch, because that's when cocaine was starting to really take a grip in the UK. We were mainly looking at the explosion of cocaine and then of crack cocaine, and the whole team became part of a joint task force with the Southeast Regional Crime Squad 7, 8 and 9. And for a year, we worked together with the police looking at the cocaine problem and mainly looking at what was termed the Yardie problem. There's West Indians, mainly Jamaicans, smuggling cocaine from the Caribbean, but also from the US in particular.
Could I just take you back just one step? You mentioned that just each team had a different letter.
It was all based on the phonetic alphabet. And each of you had a call sign that you used on the radio. When I was on the golfs, I was golf 13. When I was on the hotels, I became hotel 4. And that's when you were communicating with each other. You obviously didn't use your names over the radio. You were just used your call sign.
You're also the honey monster. When was that first used?
That's after, while I was in the Caribbean, when I was the drug liaison officer out there. When I was out there, I covered the Eastern Caribbean and Barbados, which mainly was from Barbados all the way up to Antigua and down into Guyana in South America. And obviously in the Caribbean, everybody calls you by your last name. So I'd be walking down, say, Kingston in St. Vincent, and I'd see one of the local cops I'd worked with, and all of a sudden you'd hear this shout, "Hi, honey." And of course, you'd have people looking at you because honey's my last name. And all of a sudden, one of the guys just said, "You're the honey monster," from the serial.
And that,
America's
that clearly has stuck.
It just stuck. And a lot of my friends now still know me as the honey monster.
And part of the camaraderie of what was a very close-knit group of people. And you mentioned cocaine, and there was an event where an American DEA officer came to the UK, and it changed your thinking of what would be the next big drug threat.
America was just going through the cocaine explosion, and in particular crack cocaine, which is a very addictive form of cocaine where you basically smoke it. It's been going on for years, but it just then, and at that time, became very prevalent. And he warned that this was likely to be an epidemic. You didn't smuggle crack, you smuggled coke, And then when it was smoked, it became crack cocaine, a very addictive form of cocaine.
Does this coincide with the beginnings of the big cartels and organized crime and more production in South America?
What you had was the natural outlet for cocaine at that time was America. Its proximity to South America, the cartels were targeting America and the cocaine was going up there. And then a lot of it was transshipped through the Caribbean. And of course, you've got then the natural affinity with the UK because of you know, they were part of the once empire and still part of the Commonwealth. So a lot of the people there had connections.
Yeah, I think that was allied as well, Graham, wasn't it, to the fact in the early 80s, as Escobar and a lot of the cartels were really gaining strength, they decided that they wanted to expand. And one of the obvious places for them to expand was to Europe. Why? Because they had such good geographical links, you know, loads of shipping, loads of freight, loads of opportunity. So Europe was well on the market there, but we were just a very small percentage of the overall amounts of cocaine being shipped at that stage.
So you weren't really spending a lot of time on cocaine until the early 90s?
Late 80s, certainly.
That's when the target teams, the first, you know, yeah, target teams were identified, because they could then see that coke, along with heroin, was going to become a particular problem, and it was then becoming used more and more widely than it historically had been.
And how was it getting into the UK in those days? What were the early methods and routes?
Well, what we were looking at was, in the main, it was courier traffic.
Yeah.
People flying in, suitcases of cocaine strapped to their body, inserted in their body, you know, the stuffers and swallowers.
I think Graham's absolutely right. The drug trafficking organisations in the mid-80s and even in the late 80s were using the traditional methods of importation that we'd used in the late 70s and early 80s to get it into the UK. Drug trafficking hasn't changed, Linz, in many respects, over the 35, 40 years that Graham and I have been involved in. Drug trafficking is about the production of the drugs, whether it's heroin, cocaine,
rum in the 18th century.
Yeah, or the transportation of the drugs, the distribution of the drugs, and then you've got the specialist things around communications, security, financial. You know, you have to understand that drug trafficking is a business. And one of the things of working in drugs, like Graham, for so many years, is that we understand the dynamics. We understand the anatomy of drug trafficking. So you can take one aspect of it, transport, as we're talking about now, and things they're doing today is exactly the same as the things that they were doing 20, 30 years ago.
Well, I mean, at the moment we're reading, you know, if you read the headlines in the drugs, or at the moment you're reading about things like narco subs. There are submarines coming across full of cocaine.
We've been dealing with narco submarines for over 20 years. We've been dealing with motherships coming over the pond from South America, originally to Africa or to Spain or to Europe, for over 20 years. There is nothing going on now that we haven't seen before. We've seen the Americans deploying military resources to disable go-fasts operating from Venezuela or Colombia up to maybe Florida or some of the Caribbean islands. We were seeing these things 15, 20 years ago. In our days, we didn't bomb the planes. The Americans used snipers on helicopters to disable the go-fast by firing a very large bullet into the engine. Interestingly enough, there was a case in the Middle East the other day where our Royal Marines did the same thing. In our day, our military weren't allowed to do that, but the Americans did, and we had what's called LEDETs, law enforcement detachments, on our assets in the Caribbean.
Actually, we did. We did do it. We trained the military. But then what happened was the bad guys got wise to it when they saw that we were going to shoot their engine to stop them. They used to get the junior member of the crew to lie on the engine, so we couldn't shoot at it because, of course, our policy and rules of engagement wouldn't allow us to be fatally taken out. What the Americans are doing at the moment, as you say, has been quite shown, is that, you know, four or five vessels, they've just shot them out of the water. The legality of which, I think, is questionable, very questionable, but who's going to stop them from doing it? I don't think anybody is. And certainly the intelligence that we've gained from people speaking back into the Caribbean, has it had an effect? Yes, it has. They've stopped. They're no longer bringing GoFast up at the moment because they know they do that. But have they stopped smuggling drugs? No. They're back to doing airdrops from Colombia and dropping it. And I think where the Americans are wrong is that those vessels that are coming up are pirogues, exactly what we were dealing with when I was in Barbados. As a rule, they're not crewed by Venezuelans, they're Colombians, because it's Colombian cocaine that's coming up. And in the main, none of that is going direct to Florida because the journey is far too long and there's too many difficulties once you get out of the Caribbean chain, once you get beyond Antigua, which is the furthest north, is that they can't go that far. It's too long a journey. So what they're doing is it's transshipped through the Caribbean. That's why the Caribbean is so important.
Yeah. And that's why we needed DLOs there who understood serious crime, covert policing, and working with overseas law enforcement agencies, because they were intelligence gatherers on the ground.
So, Phil, Graham's given us an outline of what he was doing in the early 90s. Were you doing similar operations, similar work?
I was paralleling Graham. In early 80s, I was still in drugs team A, Alpha, working in the Intercept office. Of course, in 1980, Duncan Campbell, that journalist, revealed that Ebury Bridge Road was, in fact, the headquarters of Intercept in the UK, and we had to move out of that office at a rush, in a day, in fact, to what we described as a hole in the wall in Westminster, and set up a separate Intercept office there. After that, I moved on quickly to teams dealing with arms trafficking, teams dealing with sending advanced technology to the Soviet Union, and then joined our specialist training team doing investigation courses for new people, running surveillance courses, running rural surveillance courses, and I did a year in the city working on economic crime. But in 1987, I was lucky enough to be promoted to be the SIO, the Senior Investigation Officer, in charge of Drugs Team F, a target team dealing with the smuggling of heroin from Southeast Asia and Iran to the UK. And I stayed as the officer in charge until 1990, when I took up my posting to Bangkok as a drug liaison officer.
What was the drug liaison officer network, and why did customs think they needed one?
Well, by its nature, serious organised crime and drug trafficking is international. A lot of the threats start overseas. So it became clear to us that one of the most effective ways of dealing with this was to send people over to source and transit countries so they could work at source to stifle the threat and take a number of different measures to upset and annoy drug trafficking groups, which we were
very good at. Build relationships with foreign police forces.
Yeah, the relationships thing was key to everything we did. We couldn't work in these countries without the support of and the advice of and help of the local police forces generally. And that was one of the primary roles of a DLO. He or she was to build effective relationships with the host agencies in a whole host of areas. And the reason for that, Linz, is that, you know, we had to have the substantial base there to allow us to do what we call controlled deliveries of drugs from the source country or the transit country to the UK. We have to have a solid footing to allow us to do mutual legal assistance requests to officers to go out and work in the country, take statements, gather evidence, gather intelligence. We had to have good relationships which would allow us to work really well with the locals when our nasty, horrible villains were identified in their countries or were travelling to these countries. You know, a lot of our people were coming over staying in hotels. We had to train them to bug hotel rooms, to break into hotels, to defeat the alarms on some places. We had to train them to do surveillance. We offered them really good equipment and trained them in that equipment in the UK or in the host country. So we gradually built up a number of special units in these countries which were supporting us in UK Limited.
And at that time in the early 80s and that, we were very dependent and grateful of the support we got from the US, particularly the Drug Enforcement Administration. We had a very good relationship with them, with their country attaché in London, who would then open the door for you when you were travelling overseas. Yeah, you did occasionally headbutt each other because they were pulling in a slightly different direction sometimes, but they were great interlockers when we went overseas. And I think there was then a realisation, you know, we shouldn't be so dependent on them. We should have our own people there who understand our culture and understand our aims and objectives. So the network sort of grew.
Well, do you remember when you applied?
Yeah, it was 1989 I first applied. The post in Miami came up and I applied for that. And I was very fortunate that I got that.
It certainly beats Southall, doesn't it, as
it
a posting?
It was a way to say it was a big contrast. And as you say, I think it's when you look back on your career, and we all joke about it now, you think, here I was, you know, a young man just come down from Scotland, get posted to Southall. Who would thought one day I'd be the UK representative in Miami? And I'm sure there are some people still to this day saying, hell, did Honey ever become that?
And Phil, did you apply as well? How did you get the job before Bangkok?
I had a slightly different running in as much as I was the SIO in charge of the heroin teams looking after Southeast Asia. We already had a post in Bangkok. We had a really good guy there, Malcolm, who'd been doing a great job out there with a small team. And I wrote a business case that we should have a more senior officer there because we covered from Bangkok the whole of Southeast Asia. It was a, you know, very hard thing to do, but you know, a number of countries in Southeast Asia have the mandatory death penalty for drugs. There was lots of geopolitics in that area out there. Malcolm had been dealing with a particularly difficult case involving the arrest of two young girls in Thailand, Smith and Carhill, and that was taking up 25% of the work of the office. We needed more resource there. So I put a business case in suggesting we put an SIO there, and lucky enough I got selected to be the person to go out there.
So tell me, when you both got home, and you must have been really delighted you got these jobs, you go home and say, guess what, my love, we're off to Bangkok or off to Miami. How did that go down?
Well, Graham and I can talk about that, but I'll just mention as an aside, when Graham and I came back from our postings, we took over the management of the Eastern Hemisphere, and at that point we were still sending people abroad who hadn't told their spouses they were being posted abroad, had never mentioned it to them. And we also dealt with problems like liaison officers who went to South America didn't come back with their spouse for some reason.
What did Mrs. Matthews and Mrs. Honey say at the time about the prospect of taking their lives to the other side of the world?
Yeah, it took a while to sink in. And it's all those early questions about where are we going to live? What's the schooling like for our kids out there? Is it safe? You know, am I going to like it? What am I actually going to do? Because many of our spouses had in jobs, and many of them had, you know, more well-paid jobs than the officers. Bearing in mind, in those early days, it was mostly guys going overseas. That changed, fortunately, later on. But mostly guys. Well, their wives gave up their job to go overseas. It was a huge...
That's an extraordinary sacrifice.
Huge,
yeah.
Sacrifice,
yeah,
for them. Yeah. You're taking them out of school. You know, my kids were 6 and 9 when I went to Bangkok, but many other the guys and girls had kids in their teens who were, you know, building up to O levels or A levels. I suffered that when I went to Washington. So it's a huge step. But on the other side of the coin was the excitement of going to
huge opportunity,
something like Bangkok.
I'll tell you a quick thing about Phil first, as an aside. I remember when Phil came back and George Atkinson was taken over from Phil. And I remember being in Phil Burns' office, and Phil said, what was the best piece of advice, George, that you got from Phil Matthews? George turned around, the best thing Phil told me is, don't go out when it's fucking raining.
That's all straight craft you got
back. Yeah, he was obviously being a bit economic with the truth, but because George is a wicked sense of humour.
George said that because my partner in Bangkok in a rainstorm had got out of his car and slipped down a drain. The manhole cover had come off the drain, and he got most horrific injuries and was in hospital for weeks and weeks and weeks, and we were very worried. Just as I went to Bangkok, the Dutch DLO, one of the Dutch DLOs died out there. He died of dengue fever, hemorrhagic dengue fever. So living and working in Southeast Asia, dealing with malaria, dengue fever, diphtheria, and a whole host of things, hepatitis, was a real problem. And those were things which worried you, the DLO, but also your wife. You know, my son got bronchial pneumonia while I was out there once. In fact, it was when my wife was back in the UK, and I didn't tell her about it for 3 or 4 days that he was in hospital with bronchial pneumonia. One of our officers, when he was posted to Delhi, became very ill, and we had to medevac him home to the hospital for tropical diseases. And eventually they found a body in the water tank in his apartment block. He was also in a hotel in the same place when the hotel burnt down and had to crawl along the floor.
He didn't have any luck there at all, did he?
He didn't have any luck.
For you, though, Graham, it was more Hollywood than Third World, because you were going to Miami. I mean, how did the conversation go, Hope?
It was a great posting, but it had its challenges in that. You're working in Miami, for instance, you've got all the federal agencies you're dealing with, the main ones, obviously the Drug Enforcement Administration, the FBI, US Customs, you had ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms, and a number of other federal, and then you had the state and local, and you know, they were running into hundreds, and you had to navigate your way through dealing with, as Phil had alluded to, it was getting good partners who you could work with within local law enforcement.
I assume in Miami, in my mind's eye, I've got you living in a beautiful apartment with lots of glass overlooking the beach. Was it like that?
No, you had better than an apartment.
No, I had an apartment in Miami on Key Biscayne.
I was right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it had the swimming pool, yeah, all of that. But again, it sounds like idyllic life, and it is. It is a great life, but it does have its ups and downs. You know, you got to remember you're 9 hours away from home, and things still happen back in the UK that you have to deal with. And while you're there, things happen. I was in Miami when Hurricane Andrew struck. Fortunately, I was on the West Coast on holiday, but we couldn't fly back to Miami and for 4 days because the hurricane had hit. And I remember to this day driving over Rickenbacker Causeway, which is the entrance into Key Biscayne. You go over the toll road, and in the middle of the road is a yacht because the hurricane had picked it up, put it in. We get back to the apartment we had, and it was destroyed. My eldest son was born in Miami, and after the first 3 months, he had serious food poisoning and was in and out of hospital. So life goes on. And of course, you then, you know, you have your colleagues who are supporting you. I was a one-man person in Miami, so you were very dependent on back in London. You had the support of the senior LO up in Washington, but you're away from your family and the support mechanism they have there. So it's all the things you have to take into account when you're abroad. You get on with it and deal with the issues there. But you are on your own.
Yeah. Firstly, we had to be vetted. So all of our guys going out and girls going overseas get subject to the highest vetting. So that takes a bit of time and a bit of effort, a bit of focus. And, you know, partners can find that incredibly intrusive when some guy turns up at your house and says, show me all your bank records for the last 2 years. And by the way, what are all your outgoings? What's all your income? Can I compare and contrast? And have you ever voted for so-and-so? Are you?
So they're vetting your partners, not just you.
Absolutely. Right. And so, but the course of training packages we went on that day was fairly basic. We went on a security course with the Foreign Office. We went on a...
What happened on the security course?
They were talking you basically about being approached by foreign nationals and enemies of the UK and being recruited as spies, which was always an interesting one because obviously one of the role and remits and main responsibilities of a DLO was to recruit informants when they were overseas. So we were pretty switched on in that area, but it was always interesting to hear their perspective. But it was also about secure communications. We then did what I call and Graham calls a Foreign Office knives and forks course, where they told you how to place your dinner settings if you were on representational duties and whether you should buy Mappingham Webb crystal glassware to go around the table. Most DLOs found that quite an amusing course. My wife wasn't over-impressed with that one. I'm sure Graham wasn't either. We also did some operational courses. We all did at that time a week on the South Coast with the SIS, the Secret Intelligence Service, at their training headquarters. And that was a course mainly around anti-surveillance, counter-surveillance, a bit of unarmed combat. We also get the chance to talk to people who worked abroad, and SIS were fantastic in putting forward people who had either served in the countries we were going to or had looked after them from a London perspective. So that was good. They had a military cell down there, which was an SBS officer, an SAS officer, and in our days, ICOR officer or SRR officer, Special Reconnaissance Regiment, experts in their field, and they were very good to us. And we learnt a lot from those guys because they'd been operating abroad in hostile environments for many, many years, doing many of the things that we wanted to do as LO. So tradecraft, we learnt from them. We did a little bit on the informant handling with them, particularly informant handling in hostile environments. Some of our posts, we were running informants single-handedly. Okay, we could take the locals along with us, which we did on some occasions, and other occasions it wouldn't have been appropriate to do that. But we put a lot of emphasis on informant handling.
Graham, you're in America rather than in a Southeast Asian country, but were you also looking for informants?
You were a diplomat, so if you were doing anything sensitive and things like around running informants or that, you wouldn't necessarily tell the ambassador or head of mission what you were exactly doing, but you always had to be aware that at the end of the day, you were representing HMG, Her Majesty's Government.
Can you remember, looking back, obviously you can't mention names, could you give us an example of an informant that was successful? And then Phil might give me an example of an informant that certainly wasn't successful.
I had a very good case. And again, it comes down to your relationship with the host agency. And I remember it well. I got a call and two guys came in and saw me in the consulate in Miami. They were two of South American background and said, oh, we've got some information about 400 kilos of cocaine in Venezuela. So I take the information, listen to it, do all the bits we have to do, register these two guys as informants. And then they start to give me more information about the cocaine, where it'll be. So I'm also then liaising with our liaison officer down in Caracas at the time to give him the information, to say this is what we've got. And the case started to build up. And then they then say where the cocaine is. And I can remember it well. Then I thought, I need a bit of cover here to make sure this, whatever it is. So I phoned the DEA up and said, these two guys are in here. And then I find out they are DEA sources as well as FBI sources, as well as customs sources. So you're trying to deconflict it. And it comes to when we're going to do the case. They go down to Venezuela. And on that day, I did phone the DEA up. And all their senior managers and the people who I interlocked with were on a management meeting. And I spoke to an agent. I said, look, you need to be aware, this is what we've got. The full details, gave their names, gave all of this. I said, I'm ringing you up to deconflict this in case it goes horribly wrong. And he says, fine, I'll make sure people who need to know it. So they're down in Venezuela. The job goes down, and the local law enforcement in Venezuela, along with our LO, had gone in to the premises and seized 400 kilos of cocaine. It was a really great job, and I felt I'd done everything that it was right. And the next day, I get a phone call from the DEA, get down to see the SAC, the head of the DEA, special agent in charge, about what you've just done. So I go down, and of course, I start to get grilled. If these were our informants, this was a job they were going to pass to us. You should have told us. And I said, with the greatest respect, please ask this agent what I did. And he said, well, Graham rang me up. He told me all about it. So I said, so what else am I meant to do? I'm one person. I've told your organisation exactly what's going to happen. And here's you giving me a hard time. And I feel I've done everything right. And then they went on, but, you know, your customs, blah, blah. And I said, yeah, I'm British customs. I'm not American customs.
So, Phil, is the best intelligence human intelligence? And how did you go about recruiting informants down in Bangkok?
Human intelligence is extremely important. It parallels technical intelligence. So in Bangkok, slightly different than Graham, because Thailand's a source country and I was responsible for UK activity in Southeast Asia. So I covered a lot of source countries and had to get around and establish the right relationships early on to tell the locals what we would be doing and looking for their assistance. But just mentioning the DEA, just to give you an example in Thailand, the DEA had more officers in Thailand than all the other countries in the world put together. They also had more money than all the other countries put together. So you could never ignore the DEA.
Why Bangkok rather than South America?
Well, Bangkok was sending heroin to America.
Coming down
Thailand.
From the Burmese border.
Yeah, from the Golden days, Triangle the Golden in those Triangle. Days, yeah. Informants were extremely important. A walk-in would be a person who comes into the embassy and says to the person at the front desk, I want to give information about drug trafficking. Obviously, it applies in other areas as well. But we had to have so who first spoke to them, who first assessed them, how did they get in touch with the DLO if we weren't in country or in post, establish that for starters. And then we would look more positively at who are the other LOs. So in Thailand, we had everybody and their brother, but I had a particularly strong relationship, and Malcolm, who was working with me, had already established a really good relationship with the Dutch, the Germans and the French, and with DEA and the Aussies, because the Aussies were strong there as well. So we would go to these agencies and say, you know, if you get information which concerns the UK, we really want to hear it. If you come across any Brits who are arrested for something, you know, we're interested in chatting with them. If you've got Brits locked up in the jails, we're interested in chatting to them, debriefing them. We would be looking to specifically recruit someone who could give us information. That doesn't necessarily mean a Brit. That could be a local, and we would run them maybe with the locals, because...
How do you go about identifying that local?
It could be quite difficult. And it could be quite dangerous from time to time. So when I got to Thailand, it was like reviewing the informants we already had on hand and a range of informants. Because sometimes you want informants who are going to talk to you about people who are dealing heroin to Brits. Why? Because it gives you the prices, it gives you availability, gives you context. You want people who are dealing with the transport side of things. How are they moving heroin from Southeast Asia to the UK and Europe? How can we influence? How can we get people in to help us identify this? Sometimes we want to know more about the finances. So people moving money, moving cash, moving assets. Buying assets in Thailand at the time was important.
You'd look for maybe contacts that the security services had.
Yeah, we'd speak to the intelligence agencies, our own intelligence agencies and the 5i intelligence agencies, but they're doing their own thing most of the time. So in the early days, they were more focused on drug trafficking, and we got tremendous support from the Secret Intelligence Service and GCHQ in Southeast Asia, and they were our life's blood to a certain extent. And that was one of the big advantages of going through extra security vetting, that we could deal with our intelligence agencies and they could deal with us. But it was down mainly to your relationships with the host agencies in Thailand, the Thai Customs, the Office of Narcotics Control Board, Thai Police particularly, and then the anti-narcotic side of the Thai Police, Thai Special Branch. And then building up relationships in all the other countries, so that if we got a problem, Graham said, you know, about political problems, ours was a Brit getting arrested in Malaysia or Singapore for drug trafficking. Nobody who's ever been arrested in Malaysia or Singapore and been convicted of drug trafficking has ever had a reprieve. They've been hung. So you do not want a Brit arrested in those countries.
Also wondering, from an outsider's point of view, what's in it for the informant?
Well, the informant mostly is driven
why
by
they
money.
Want to talk to you. Yeah. So money has to change hands. You're
money
allowed to. You're allowed
regularly
to pay
changed in, hands. Yeah, and we paid informants.
You're allowed to pay informants.
Yeah, and we paid them depending on results. But often we would also pay them for expenses as well to go out and do things we tasked them to do. And like any good bureaucratic department, we expected receipts. But it wasn't always money. That was the most important motive, but it could be revenge against a person or another drug trafficking group.
Well, can you remember a time when misinformation was deliberately planted on you in Miami?
There's several occasions where you have, and again, it's about testing the... The first thing you always do with an informant is test what they're telling you. As Phil said, what is their motive and what are they actually telling me? And then you try and work out, you know, is what they're giving you correct? At the end of the day, you know somewhere along the line an informant is going to be a problem.
So one of the first cases I dealt with was an informant who came to us and offered us information about some British people who were attempting to smuggle multi-tons of cannabis from Thailand to the UK. So we brought a team out from the UK who worked for many months following these people around, and we were able to corroborate very early on the essence of what this informant was telling us. And it was really, really good. We worked really hard on this team for a considerable period. And then one early in the morning, I got a phone call from a colleague at the embassy to say, oh, the informant had been arrested by Thai police smuggling heroin. And he got 50 years in prison for that. So his motive was to pull the wool over our eyes, to support his illegal activities by, on the one hand, giving all this information, working with us and ties, etc., but whilst he was actually smuggling heroin. And he pays your money, takes your chance.
From my perspective, the other thing in from me wasn't just in running informants, is because Miami was... You know, it was like the Clapham Junction of drug trafficking. So it wasn't just trafficking. The other main thing that you had there was money laundering. So I would say I spent 50% of my time looking at cash flow, looking at money, looking at cases where money was involved. And at some point in every smuggling organisation, there will be a nexus into Miami because of that closeness to South America, Caribbean, and then because the nexus then to the UK. So a lot of the cases, the major traffickers you were looking at, something would happen in Miami. So you were there supporting the efforts of the operational team back in the UK. And there's two cases I got involved with, both on the money side, which were significant. The first case involved, it was cannabis smugglers based in East Anglia, and they'd ended up buying property in the panhandle of Florida. I didn't know anybody in Panama City Customs, but I knew somebody in Tampa who I'd worked with, phoned him up and said, can you introduce me to anybody in Panama City who could help me? He said, yeah, one of my best friends is up there. So you phoned him up, explained the situation, and I said, I know it'll be a bit difficult to get the bank details, but I know he's got a bank account with Sunbank up there. I know where it is, and I think I've got the number because this had all been passed to me by the UK. So the guy says, yeah, don't worry about it. An hour later, he phones me up and said, yeah, there's $250,000 in the bank account. And I'm like, how did you do that? And he went, no, we just know there's $250,000. And so you don't ask the question. So you're able to report back to the UK, yep, all the information you've given me is correct. They're there and they've located the property he's bought. So, of course, the UK then has to swing into action. to get all the official documentation so we can get the Americans to get a warrant to search the premises, get a warrant to seize the money. And all that was done. And the US Customs guys and the attorneys I was dealing with were absolutely fantastic. You couldn't have asked for more. So they did all of that. And I actually went up when they were searching the house. I wasn't searching because I didn't have the authority, but I was there watching the guys and they're picking all the evidence up. And when we got out of this property, I looked down and I was covered in dog fleas all the way up my trousers and everything, because the place was in a really bad state. But we got the property sold, seized, sold, and all. The asset sharing agreement with the US had just been signed, and it was the first asset sharing case. And without a DLO there, you would never, ever have got that.
Graham, how did the drug trafficking organisations evolve in the 1990s in terms of production, transport and money laundering?
I think just over the years, there then became an exponential increase in trafficking, particularly on the cocaine side. And it is slightly ironic that I think some of the big cases we did, and I think of Operation Journey, Operation Jezebel, when it was the multi-ton shipments of cocaine that were coming over from South America into Europe, which were also targeting the UK, we started to have quite a bit of success on those. And a lot of that success was generated by the Drug Liaison Officer Network. We then worked with other agencies, and that then led to the identification of these multi-ton shipments coming over. Everybody was saying, nah, you're living in another world. This isn't right. This isn't correct. We didn't believe it.
It fundamentally changed our thinking on how cocaine was transported to the UK. We were not looking at boats, motherships, coming across the pond to Europe and dropping it off to sister ships and into Europe. It was absolutely not on our radar. So that was a critical change to the way we're thinking. So while we're doing all this good work in another area, real work was going on in a different part of the forest.
Yeah, because the traffickers had then really identified Europe as where they were going to make money. You know, the US market was saturated. You saw the increase of cocaine usage in Europe and in the UK in particular. And they saw there is a market. Because, again, it goes back to these guys are doing this for one thing and one thing only, money.
And I'm also struck by how it's just a classic business model. We want more customers.
Yeah.
And there are more customers in Europe, so that's where we're going to send our...
And all our covert collection capabilities around the world, we'd never had a sniff of the trafficking groups in South America sending multi-tons over in ships they controlled over the pond. It comes back to the point you were making, Inns, and we were talking about earlier. It comes back to relationships. And for us, it was a light bulb moment. It was like, oh my God, we're doing all this really good work in other areas, which is producing some good results. But this has been happening probably for a year, and we hadn't noticed.
How many tons are we talking about on some of these ships?
50 tons.
Well, overall, within the organisations, but you were getting between 4 to 10 tons
per
vessel.
Huge amounts.
It wasn't that the agencies in the States didn't know what to do with it. They didn't have the access that we had built with the various intelligence services in the UK.
In a later life, I had a big team working at GCHQ, and we also had a team working at SIS, fully embedded over there. We had that trust with them. They had that trust with us. Nothing we were going to do was going to burn their capabilities, because their capabilities are being used in other areas, counter-espionage, counter-terrorism, uh-huh, counter-subversion. They do not want a case of a drug trafficking organisation exposing a long-term capability. There's always a very difficult balance to say, We are protecting a long-term strategic capability here. We're not going to burn this on a short-term tactical gain.
Difficult decisions to make.
They're very difficult decisions. If a chief constable's got the biggest job on his or her hands and it may be involved a murder, and we can give him the exact location of where the murder weapon is or where some evidence is buried or where the person has fled to, fantastic, that should be done. But if it burns a long-term strategic capability of UK government, we're never going to do that. And I was very lucky in another job to be that keyhole whereby it went through me because the agencies knew I was never going to do that. The Met at that time of Cressida Dick and John Yates and Janet Williams and Sue Akers and Sharon Kerr, they understood that. They absolutely understood that. So they come to me with a problem. We discuss it in the team and say, we can deal with that. This is how we parallel evidence it. So we're going to do this and find that for you, but you need to go out and parallel evidence that. So when it gets to court, you've got an audit trail there which doesn't reveal us. Fine. That's how it works in the real world.
And that came to, you know, really hit home when we were doing Journey. We'd given the Spanish a 5-ton seizure on a vessel. And after about 10 minutes, I don't speak any Spanish or that, but it's all getting interpreted. But I could tell by the tenure of this voice, we're getting bollocked here by this guy because we wouldn't share with him the source of our intelligence. And he kept asking us. And we said, no, we can't give it to you. You just need to know you got the intelligence, you've got the seizure. And it was a really uncomfortable meeting. And you come out of there and you think, we've given them 5 tons. They should be happy, but they wanted to know more.
Next time on Narco Warriors, hunting drug smugglers in Thailand.
He threatened to kill me, had a gun, had turned up at the embassy, presumably to shoot me.
A place where alliances were blurred and survival meant knowing who to trust.
It became very clear to us that his real motive was revenge.
And how the region is still at the centre of a trade that never really stopped.
So if you're a young person out there thinking of going out to Southeast Asia or anywhere to pick up anything which you think is illegal and you've been asked to smuggle it, think about it. The consequences can be catastrophic, not just for you, but for your family.
These are the Narco Warriors. Join us again soon.